This episode is brought to you by SD Sober Living. If you or someone you know needs a safe and supportive recovery home, then reach out to SD Sober Living at www.sdsoberliving.org or call 619-625-0769. That's 619-625-0769. Come get some San Diego recovery and some fuck fentanyl at SD Sober Living. Welcome to the Fuck Fentanyl Podcast. I am Luis Romero, and I am the Fuck Fentanyl guy. Today, I have another great guest. This is my friend, my homie, Nate. I've known Nate for a little minute. We attend a home group together, and, you know, I'm pretty familiar with his story. And, you know, he's definitely lived a life, you know, riddled with addiction and particularly with opiates. And how are you doing, Nate?
I'm doing pretty good, brother. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, of course, man. So, man, like I said before, man, start me off however you want to start it off. So.
All right. Sounds good. I'll do a little bit of stuff about childhood and things on that line.
Yes. Give me all that.
I'm from Huntington, West Virginia. It's a small community in West Virginia. We're teeny tiny compared to San Diego.
Oh, of course. For sure. Yeah.
But in that area, we actually have a very prominent drug use, unfortunately.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mainly due to the back when Opanas and OxyContin were the name of the game.
Oh, okay.
So we got hit really, really hard with that, mainly because most of the people that work in West Virginia, we work in the mines or we work in steel mills.
Yeah, they covered that in that documentary.
Yep.
Was it Painkiller or was it the other one? The Dope Sick.
Dope Sick.
Dope Sick, yeah.
You also get to hear a little bit about it in the documentary Recovery Boys is another one.
Oh, really?
Where they deal with these guys that they pretty much... they put you on a farm, and that's how you get sober, is living the farm life.
Oh, fuck, yeah. Well, I kind of had an experience like that, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Painkillers and heroin became really, really big from the 90s to the early 2000s.
Yeah,
It got huge whenever pill mills and things started out.
Oh, shit.
So then we go back to when I was a kid. It really wasn't that bad.
Okay, yeah.
I got pretty lucky. I got a good family unit, a mom, dad that are still married to this day, 36 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, I got lucky. And got a brother and a sister. But unfortunately, a lot of my stuff started when I was very young. I dealt with a sexual assault when I was a kid. Okay. Two different times.
Wow.
Which eventually led to me kind of realizing, okay, the world isn't all sunshine and daisies really early on.
Yeah.
And then it led into, I was prescribed before they realized how bad Adderall was for kids.
Uh-huh.
They gave me like 154 milligrams a day.
Of Adderall?
Of Adderall.
Oh, Jesus. So you're tweaking.
All the time. All the time. At an early age.
Yeah, Jesus. Started young.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. And because of that, because of the naivety of being a kid, you know, you're 10 years old, you don't realize what these medications are. When I ran out of the time release, the capsules, I decided that I was going to take the 5 milligram instance at the same dosage that you would for the time release. So I took 154 milligrams worth of instant release.
Wow.
And so 10, 11 years old, that was my first overdose.
Shit, dude.
Was on Adderall.
Holy fuck.
So I went hard, fast.
Fast.
And
damn, so you OD'd and then what they called the ambulance and they just...
It wasn't an OD in the sense that, you know, it took me out. It was an OD in the sense that I severely over-medicated myself. Like the more of the definition style of OD rather than falling out.
Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. So they called my mom because they knew something was up because the quiet kid is now jumping off the wall.
Okay.
Can't sit still.
For sure. You're on a sick one.
Oh yeah. And so my mom came to school and she's an RN and realized what had happened almost immediately. Because I was like, I just took my medication like I normally did. She's like, you were out of your medication. How did you take your medication?
Yeah.
And that led to a long conversation about how drugs can affect the body and how time release works compared to instant. And my mom sitting me down and talking to me about all this stuff. Yeah. It's also when the DARE program was just coming around hardcore.
Yeah,
so that. I was learning all about like all these different drugs and how they can make you feel normal. And I was also dealing with a lot of bullying at the time. So I was trying my hardest to find a place to fit in. And the people that did not judge me, comparatively speaking to the rest of the groups that I hung out with, were the ones that were the weird kids.
Yeah. Okay.
The ones that, you know, we're going to smoke plastic and all that kind of stuff.
Smoke plastic.
Yeah, exactly. Like you get a bunch of really weird guys. Yeah. And those were the people that were cool with me. Unfortunately, those are the guys that also did Lortab, Xanax, were chugging cough syrup, doing acid, things like that.
Yeah.
So by the time I was like 13, I'd already dabbled in everything that a kid can get a hold of, really. So like pills, things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was always trying to get rid of the trauma of my past because those two violent sexual assaults that happened to me really screwed my head up really bad. And then, you know, I got buried alive when I was a kid too.
Jesus. Yeah. Who fucking did that? Like, what the fuck?
My, and I cannot stress this air quote enough, friends did that.
Oh my. The weirdos fucking plastic?
No, the ones before that. The ones I used to hang out with.
Gotcha.
They buried me in a hole, put a sled on top of it, poured more dirt on top of it, and then left me there for 6 hours until my dad figured out that I wasn't home.
God damn, dude.
Yeah, so that really framed a lot of things, which is ironic because you'd think I'd be scared of small spaces.
I'd be claustrophobic as fuck for the rest of my life.
I ended up working in tanks when I was an adult.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so it did.
We can fast forward a little bit, but yes. Yeah.
But it's one of those things where like you think it would affect you more hardcore, but that wasn't the one that really bothered me. It was the fact that I felt powerless as it was happening to me. So whenever I discovered, you know, painkillers, like at 12, 13 years old, did some Lortab with some friends, you know, something big and new and, you know, tried that and figured out very quickly that I really like the kind of relief that gives me.
Yeah.
And, then mixing it with like, codeine, mixing it with, Xanax and all these other things that my friends could get a hold of because we were pretty much all of us were highly medicated, so we all had something to bring to the table. Like, I'll bring the Adderall if you bring the Xanax, you bring the Lortabs.
Yeah,
and it just became this hodgepodge of just like crushing up all these pills together, mixing them together, then doing them all in one go, which really formed later on in life how I ended up doing drugs because I didn't care what you put in me.
Yeah,
like it was just, oh, you need a tester? Come here, and I was that guy.
Yeah,
that I, some of my friends called me the trash can because you could put anything inside me and I wouldn't die.
Trash can. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
And that was a big part of that. It eventually led to a big family sit down when all of my family kind of started figuring out, oh, he has a problem.
Mm.
And my entire mom's side of the family, all my uncles, my grandfather, all served in the military.
Okay.
So my granddad was a military police officer.
Oh, fuck yes.
E9 of the Air Force, highest you can get. And,
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. And he sat me down along with one of my other uncles, who was also a military police officer.
Wow.
And then my two other uncles were also there, but they served in mechanic roles in the Air Force. So they all sat me down. They said, okay, look, you've got a problem. We think the military can fix it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. It's going to fix all of it.
Fix all your problems.
And so they sat me down with that conversation. And they also mentioned, and I'll never forget this moment. They said, it's either you or your brother. Your brother's in theater. Who do you think is going to make it in the military?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And they weren't bad people. They just, you know, they kind of understood that the more hardcore the two brothers, the one that's been in fights, done all this stupid stuff, and also like I scored a 98 on my ASVAB.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, so like as soon as they found that out, they're like, you can choose anything you want to do, just join. Like you can choose a safe job.
You could join any branch.
Yeah. And what did I do just to spite the system? Instead of going Air Force and Navy like the rest of my family, I was like, nope, Army.
Army?
Yep.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Yeah, so I went into the military at 18 years old as a 45 kilo 92 Foxtrot, a tank turret repairman, small arm specialist.
Oh, fuck yeah, dude.
And I still remember
You weren't trying to get no desk job, man.
No, no. I wanted to be close enough to the action that I could say I was there, but far enough away that, you know,
you're
immediate
not,
death.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess I call it smart. Some people call it cowardice. I'm still going to stick with smart because I didn't feel like getting killed.
Conscious is objector.
Oh, yeah. almost. But it ended up with me joining, and I went through boot camp at Fort Jackson back in 2008.
Yeah.
Graduated in June. I was in boot camp by July.
Oh, shit, yeah. Dude.
And so I went hard. I went fast. I ended up going from Fort Jackson to Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland my AIT, which is your advanced individual training. It's where boot camp is where you learn how to be an infantryman. AIT is where you learn your role in the military.
Mm.
So everybody's an infantryman first.
For sure, yeah.
Then you learn your job.
Okay.
And the 45 kilo designation, which was the one that I started out with,
mm-hmm.
that designation is one of the top 10 hardest to pass. Medic is harder.
It is.
Yes, medic is one of the hardest to pass because there's so much information you've got to
learn and consume short
and then be able to regurgitate back to pass the tests. And it's the same thing with tank mechanics. Like, I didn't work on the engines. I worked on the turrets.
Oh, so that's a whole different...
whole other ball game. You're working with guidance systems. You're working with hydraulics. You're working with ammunition. You're working on specialized equipment, specialized rounds.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and it's made in the... can't talk about how old it was.
Oh, but, no worries.
But they're older, so some of the equipment is one of those things where you kind of look at it like, they still use that? What the... I didn't even know that was still around. But yeah, there was moments like that in the military. But
that's so funny.
One of the things that a lot of people think is when you join the military that your drug habits don't follow you.
That
ain't true.
I've been to enough recovery meetings. It's not true.
The military is in droves in recovery.
Yeah.
Whether it be alcoholism or drug addiction. Because they've got what they like to call battlefield medicine.
Yeah.
And battlefield medicine isn't what it sounds like. It's not just used on a battlefield. It's also used back home. Now, this is an old policy. I don't think they still do this, but
it
wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
The old policy used to be if somebody gets hurt, you fill them with pain medication. You fill them with antibiotics. You just keep hitting them with it until they sleep everything off and eventually they heal.
Yeah.
And on paper, it sounds great. It doesn't work that way, though.
Yeah.
So while I was in the military, I got hurt. I was prescribed 2 Oxy 80s a day, 3 Roxy 30s a day, 4 Lortab 10s as needed, and morphine 30s as needed, up to 2 of them a day. And I was given all of that and then told, you know, hey, get better. And that was after a catastrophic knee injury. Had a road spike go through my left kneecap.
Oh, shit.
Nothing heroic. I tripped, fell, landed on that. It's the ultimate clumsiness right there. And that was in full battle rattle. So,
oh, no shit.
Yeah, so I had like 150 extra pounds on my body at the time, including vest, rifle, rucksack, whole 9 yards.
Yeah.
So when I tripped and fell, all that pressure just forced that son of a gun through my knees
break
so hard.
Fucking leg.
And I partially tore my ACL at the same time.
Oh, God damn.
So they loaded me up with all these pain medications.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed up under Bush, but I got out under Obama.
Okay.
And under the Obama administration, anybody that had anything deemed over 20% disability with a catastrophic injury, like what I had sustained, was to be medically discharged.
Oh, no shit.
Which is cool and not cool at the same time. Like, if that's your goal to stay in, then it sucked. And that was my goal, was to stay in.
So
when I was told that I was getting a medical discharge, I was like, okay, it's game over. Now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on all these pain medications. I'm still, you know, doing what I'm supposed to do.
How long did you serve?
4 years.
Okay.
From 2008 to 2012.
Okay.
I didn't get to do the long haul. Wanted to so bad. Yeah. But when I got hurt, I went back home for a couple months during the healing process. Didn't realize that I had not signed all the documentation and smoked pot while I was at home. Then got called back to do the last medical exam.
Yeah.
For my exit out of the military.
Yeah.
And explaining to a medic, yeah, I don't want to take this piss test. And
wow.
They're like, well, why? I thought I was out. I thought I was already out. I smoked weed. And as long as you're kind of honest with them and it's nothing hardcore, they don't get on your ass too bad.
Oh, okay.
So I still received a medical discharge, which is just a general discharge. Yeah. No dishonorable. I got very, very... My higher power likes to look out for me. If you can't tell from the stories you're about to hear.
And with that sort of discharge, that means you get to keep your benefits and.
I can if I want them. I to this day will not take them. I have never signed the paperwork to receive the benefits. I will not take the benefits, and that's more a pride thing on my end, which is probably not great.
Sure,
but the way I've always looked at it is if I can still work. I can still do all the things that I need to do. There are guys out there that can use it more than me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to take from those guys, especially when I got hurt stateside and there's guys that come back without arms, legs, hardcore trauma to the head, just all these things. So it's one of those points of pride with me that, you know.
Yeah, you just felt like it's not necessary.
It's not necessary for me. I can still work. I still got skills. I'm okay. I got full mobility. I can do jumping jacks now.
Fuck yeah, dude.
But I got exceedingly lucky and very, very blessed that I have a higher power that looked out for me. But when I got back home and I went to go try and fill my prescriptions for all the medications I was still currently taking, they denied all of them.
Oh, shit.
Except for the lower tabs. They said, you know, hey, you're done. Like, this is the prescription. You've already run out. Lower tabs are the only one still active because those I weren't popping all the time. They weren't that strong. So I just, never really went through all those. I went through all the rest like they were freaking Tic Tacs.
Yeah.
But when I was home, all my friends found out that I was back. And these are all the people that were, for the last 4 years, kept doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
And it was when OxyContin was slowly changing into Opana. Like, it was when it was doing that change of hands on my side of the states.
Oh, okay.
Because you stopped being able to find Oxys, but Opanas were everywhere.
Oh, okay.
And so people were doing that switch. Mm-hmm. And all my friends were like, man, you're still in a lot of pain. I can help you out. And so my friends would just feed me free drugs for a while.
Oh, wow.
That lasted for about a month and a half, 2 months. Then one day it was... Nah, man, it's $80. Like, oh. Okay.
Come on.
All right, here we go.
Come on, man.
Come on, dude, help a brother out. But at that same time, I had gotten a job working as a certified nursing assistant.
Oh, okay.
So I'd started working in the medical field the same time that I was abusing medication.
Awesome.
So, you know, real shitbag moment there. But it ended up giving me an in as far as, like, some of the terrible things that I'd end up doing later.
Because
eventually the Opanas ran out because all the pill mills got shut down.
Yeah.
Up and down the side of the coast. Yeah. So everybody overnight, it felt like for me, what went from, I got this. I ain't got shit except heroin right now, man. That's all I got left for you.
Oh, my God.
And
wow.
Yeah, so it felt like it was just an overnight shift, and for like 4 days, because that was we draw these lines in the sand during our addiction. Like, I'm never gonna do that because you know then I'm got a real problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I lasted four fucking days, and then called my dude. Is like, you said you had how much? And
how much you got some of that heroin? All
right, yeah, I'm coming. All right, let's do this. And that started out that trend of me just stopping caring. Mm-hmm. And I worked in the medical field. I had access to a medical closet.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times my dude would hit me up, hey, man, can you get any needles?
Oh, shit.
And things like that. And so I would trade needles for
shit.
And I did terrible things because of that. Now, they're overstocked. It wasn't like a little mom and pop spot, but it was still not good.
Yeah.
And I can... thank God say this, that was the worst I did as far as like my job and me stealing from them
taking
was
their needles.
Just needles and tourniquets. They don't need those. We use those all day, every day.
Yeah.
We have 57 boxes of them. We're okay if if one goes missing.
Yeah.
And that was how I rationalized it, was, you know, this isn't super important.
Yeah.
And, you know, we make stupid mistakes in that.
Yeah.
One of the other dumb things I used to do was I would fix people's weapons up from where I worked with small arms and ammunition in the military.
Okay, for sure.
Whenever people would hit me up and they're like, hey, man, can you work on thus and such and make it full auto? Or can you do this and, you know, make it so, you know, there's no stock on anymore and safely do it? They would call me up all the time. Then they make deals with me like, hey, I'll give you this much if you do this for me. And I'm like, all right, cool. So that's how I fed my addiction for a long time, was just doing these terrible, terrible deals with these not so great people.
They didn't have the best intentions.
No. Why do you need a fully automatic? How many deer are you hunting?
Yeah, for sure.
It's a whole herd, promise you. Because, I was a hunter, like, back home. Mm-hmm. Like, I would hunt. I did fishing. I did all the classic country boy things that you can think of. Like, my backyard, if I walked 10 feet out whenever I lived on my own, I was in the woods. The joke among my friends used to be, hey, you can just open your sliding glass door and you can go hunting. I'm like, yeah, I could. We're not doing that, though. That's real loud. But I would do that kind of stuff, and that's what got me into, started getting me on radars that I didn't want to be on. Because, you know, I am a veteran.
Yeah.
I am working in the medical field at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm also doing an obscene amount of drugs all the time, whether it be heroin, cocaine, drinking at the bar. Yeah. I was a blackouter.
Like,
that was my goal. Every time that I went out was, okay, I need to drink more. Because the way me and my friends, all of them, would drink and do drugs was do as much as you can right now before the guy next to you beats you and drinks more. Because we'd all bring like 30 racks of Miller Lite while doing blow, and then I would disappear because I was the weird one that did heroin. And
you on the low.
Yeah, the rest of my friends are doing cocaine and drinking, and then I'm just like, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
Gotta go use the bathroom real quick. Then come back out, and all of a sudden, Nate went from really, really high up there to like real calm.
Oh, relax.
Everything's great.
Yeah.
And none of my friends really put it together very quickly because
They were probably high.
Hell yeah!
You know what I mean? They weren't paying attention.
No. Like these kind of friends, and I say that loosely. They'd give themselves GHB. Like they weren't the brightest bunch. Like it's like, okay, this is what you're gotcha. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said it's stronger than this. I'm like, yeah, I bet you it is. Just don't drink on it. You won't wake up. But those are the kind of people I palled around with.
Yeah.
And I did really good there for a while. I met a woman during all that, too, that was my ex-fiance now. And still think so highly of this woman. I don't know anybody else that would have put up with all the crap that I put them through and still, like, reach out to me occasionally.
Wow.
Because during from the 2010-ish area all the way up to 2017, she was a person that was in my life.
Oh, okay.
And she stuck with me through me getting out of the military. She stuck with me through my drug addiction. I tried so hard to get me help. Didn't realize that I was an addict for the longest time because she was a normie. Barely drank anything along those lines.
Okay.
Like it was hilarious because I can still remember she smoked weed with me a handful of times. And one of the times really sticks out because she would ask for a water. I'd bring her a water bottle. Yeah. And then at one point I looked at the table and there's like 20 water bottles. I'm like, honey, if you drank any of those, she's like, I've taken a sip, but then it gets warm. I'm like, oh, okay. So, and that was after smoking like half of a joint.
Oh,
like,
fuck
so
yeah.
That'll put you in, you know, her half a joint is my like fucking gram and a half.
Yeah.
At a time.
Yes.
And she never caught on. She just thought I was a hardcore alcoholic till I overdosed in front of her on Valentine's Day.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Very romantic.
Oh, yeah. And down we go.
Yeah.
And she was me. I still remember that because I ended up working with the CMT years later.
Yeah.
But I went down while she was making heart-shaped burgers in the kitchen, and we lived in we lived in this horrible, horrible duplex where the counter was held up by a 2x4 on one side. Yeah,
that's awesome.
I took out the 2x4 on the way down.
The counter just fell right out.
Counter fell, hot grease all over my chest. I'm down and out. I don't remember any of that. And I wake up to my mom, Fran, my ex, mm-hmm. and two EMTs, one who I will affectionately refer to as Fat Jesus. And because I thought I was dead, and this man had long hair, and big guy. And
you this, already crossed the other side.
And I'm like, man, you're heavier than I thought you'd be.
Wow, Jesus.
You put on some pounds, buddy.
Heaven's been good to you.
Yeah. But I remember looking up and seeing him with the light in the background and going, oh, shit, I fucked up. Because my mom's there.
Yeah.
My ex-fiance's there. There are two EMTs.
Yeah.
And I can hear my landlord out front because he lives below me.
Fuck, yeah.
But, you know, I'm sitting there talking to everybody, and they're like, yeah, we had the Narcan you three times to wake you up. I'm like, oh, great.
Oh, shit.
And my mom, being an RN, looked and said, you used Narcan? And they said, yeah. My mom looked down at me, and
oh, so she knows exactly
what's up. She knew exactly what was up immediately.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she's a nurse.
She's a, yeah, in the field, yeah. No.
But my ex-fiance, God love her, but she didn't know what any of that fucking
yeah,
meant.
Yeah.
So she's sitting there just going, huh?
Nah, yeah.
Is that like an anti-alcohol thing? Because yeah. I know, because I had gone in for a routine procedure that day, which is what took me out.
Mm.
Was they put me under anesthesia. Then I went home and did a shot.
Oh, okay. So she kind of was thinking that
keep
was
the
that.
High going.
Keep the high, yeah.
She just thought it's from where I had a shot while I still had anesthesia in my system. So
gotcha,
she's
gotcha.
Being the happy-go-lucky girl that I always knew. And my mom's just looking at me going, I know what the fuck you did.
Yeah.
And
I know what's up.
Yeah, I know what's up. And I still remember my mom lived two blocks from where we lived.
Yeah.
And with my dad, of course. But my mom was watching my niece, who was a little kid at the time. And Fran called her and said, Nathaniel is out cold on the floor and his lips are turning blue. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going on.
Shit.
And my mom's one that did CPR on me until EMTs got there.
Mm-hmm.
And Fran was out in the car at first with my niece. And then my sister arrived on scene and watched my niece out in the car, but didn't want to leave because she didn't know what was going on with me. No one knew what was going on with me. They assumed that, you know, I had had a heart attack or something else had happened that was more akin to alcohol rather than drugs.
Yeah. It's better to be known as an alcoholic than I think than a heroin addict.
It is so much more socially acceptable.
Yeah. You just like to have a few too many.
I just like to have a few shots. What kind of shots? Don't ask. But that was the kind of stuff. And it is the, like, West Virginia is that border of North and South. And
oh, okay.
So,
oh, you're in West Virginia.
Yeah.
West
Virginia, not Virginia.
Yeah, they're different.
Very, very different.
I learned that.
The biggest difference I can say is we're the only state that when you think of Appalachia, there's only one state that is completely in the Appalachian region, and that is West Virginia.
Oh.
We're the only one. Everything else is just partial. Like, there's a little bit of Maryland and a little bit of Pennsylvania, a little bit of Tennessee, a little bit of Virginia. Only West Virginia is completely in the Appalachian Mountains.
Oh, no.
It's the only one.
Wow.
Yeah, so because of that, whenever I hear people talk about moonshiners, like, you're talking about my people. That's where that comes from. It ain't just Tennessee whiskey. Like,
yeah.
We actually have springs where that's all people still do. Because in my state, you can still legally make moonshine for yourself. You can't sell it,
okay.
But you can make it.
For yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
No one ever just makes it for themselves. But
yeah, of course. Yeah.
But as long as you're not selling it, you're good. But
yeah.
So alcohol is very much accepted. Not in my family, because my mom and dad don't drink. They don't smoke cigarettes. They don't do drugs, nothing. My mom's a nurse. My dad's a teacher. No.
Yeah, they don't need it.
There's always been the joke of there's four professions in my family. Nurse, teacher, soldier, preacher. those are your options. And the running joke was, and Nate's done all of them. I'm like, yeah, I guess I have. That's awesome. Love my life.
You're a real West Virginia boy.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, that led to questions. That led to my first attempt at rehab, like a month after that, which failed because the first rehab I went to was in the same city that I used in.
Mm-hmm.
Across the street where I could, there's a, the Route 60.
Uh-huh.
And then across from Route 60 is the flood wall for the Guyandotte River. And then across that flood wall, I could see the top of my dealer's house from the window I was getting detoxed in, knowing that I had $300 behind the nurse's station.
Ooh.
So that lasted the weekend. Then,
that's impressive.
I lasted until they did groups. And then they were like, everybody come in here. And they're like, hey, you're never going to get sober if you don't go to groups. And I fucking cuss that man out so bad. I said, I will get sober my fucking own. You know, just all the stupid things we say.
Yeah, of course.
And went to the nurse's station, checked out, MA, and then just meandered on across the Route 60, made it over to Guyandotte.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Said, hey, man, how come you didn't call me? Phone ain't working, but I'm here. You got something? And, you know, by the time I ended up back at my house, which was across town, which isn't like San Diego, thank God. It was only a 45-minute walk.
Okay.
But by the time I got home, they'd already been informed that I had AMA'd. No one knew where I was. My phone wasn't on.
Yeah.
And no one could find me because I knew that they had put a tracker, that Laugh 360 app.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had put that app on my phone when I went to detox to make sure that they're like, yeah, you're going to stay there.
Mm.
If your phone's off, though, it doesn't work. Okay. So,
oh, good to know.
Yeah, don't use that one. But that was one of those moments where when Fran saw me, she cried.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell, oh, this is the beginning of the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can already see this is how it's gonna go.
Yeah.
And me and her made it work for another like year and a half, and then it came to a head when she hit me with a frying pan, and for half a second, I can't even stress that enough. For half a second, I fucked up, and I reached out and grabbed her by the neck, and then let go instantly after she hit me with a frying pan, and she left. Like within 2 days. And I don't blame the woman. Like I would leave too. You've got a drug addict that's an alcoholic that just did an unspeakable thing. Yeah. And that is something I still have to live with every day is that I turned this sweet, loving, caring human being that stuck with me through and through into someone that hates me, but still talks to me these days every now and again. Not very often.
Yeah, but just to check in.
Yeah, just check in. And when I made my amends with her, oh my God, I cried like a baby the entire time.
I bet.
Because that was the only real hardcore thing that I can say that I can remember clearly that really made me think, oh, you've crossed that line. You're a piece of shit now.
Yeah.
And within 3 months, I was like, she left.
Mm-hmm.
Within a month, I was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 months after that, it was winter in West Virginia.
Oh, Jesus.
When I was homeless.
Doesn't sound good.
I was a bad country song. I was living in my truck with my dog.
And
I was homeless. I was living on the in the riverfront in the Ohio River Valley, which if anybody knows that, it gets cold.
Okay. Like it sounds like it does.
Oh, like we're talking 20s and below all the time.
Oh, God.
And did that for a hot minute. And then finally reached out to my mom and said, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I need help. And I need help, like, from you, not from an institution. It's not going to work if it's an institution. And she did. She she helped all right.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No worries, man.
So I went over to my mom's.
Mm-hmm.
I went into they have a finished attic at my parents' house. They've lived in the same house my entire life. And I got locked in that attic.
Uh-huh.
With a bed, toilet, and a small little like kitchenette style setup, and left there, and I detoxed in my mom and dad's house. That's cool. How I got off of it the first time.
Oh,
and my brother came by with a big bag of shake, I was like, smoke this, because I was vomiting. I couldn't keep anything mm-hmm. down. So my brother, being the saint that he is, brought me some weed, brought yeah. me some whiskey, and said, just roll with it. Roll yeah. through this. Get through this.
Yeah.
And because that was socially acceptable. Marijuana and liquor, that's yeah, fine, yeah, as long yeah. as you're not doing hard drugs.
Right, right.
Well, it just started off a whole new thing.
Mm.
I just traded addictions.
Yeah.
I went from being this hardcore pill head, like heroin loving mm-hmm. guy, to I'd always drank, but now that's solely what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it went from a pint to a fifth to a liter to a half gallon to a gallon really quickly daily.
Jesus, really?
Yeah. Because oh, I wanted to be on that same level that I was on when I was on opiates.
Yeah, just chasing that.
And the only way you can really do that with alcohol is just to continuously and constantly drink.
Yeah.
And so I just traded. I went from one substance to another. And at the same time, I'm still working in the medical field at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working Alzheimer's dementia care the entire time that I was doing like hard drugs. Then I went from doing that to, ironically, working in a mental health institution on a forensic psychological.
Jesus, really?
Yeah, I went from working with old crazy people to working with criminally crazy people.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And you have to be on your A game yeah. when you work with forensic patients, because they are rapists, murderers, yeah. arsonists.
Yeah.
Some of the most extreme
cases.
Yeah. And they're the ones that they don't go to jail because they're crazy. So they come to you. And it's not the socially acceptable way of saying that, but.
No. Yeah. I know exactly where you're coming from.
It's one of those things where you're like, you feel bad until. Like, you read profiles, because you have to read everybody's profile.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah.
So I read some stuff that, you know, HIPAA can't repeat any of it.
Of course.
But I read some things that even the most hardcore person on the planet, if they have any kind of heart at all, if they read some of that stuff, they would vomit, like, almost immediately. Because it's just terrible things that people do to each other.
Yeah.
And that just fed my little inner thoughts of, okay, let's not think about that ever, and let's just get blackout drunk all the time
yeah.
when we're not working, mm-hmm. which led to me getting stabbed at one point because I was hungover at work, mm-hmm. and I wasn't paying attention, and one of the people that worked with me beforehand had left a pen out. Patient had grabbed and held on to the pen, and he was convinced that I was in a biker gang.
You're a biker again.
Yeah,
give him no vibes about that, by the way.
He was absolutely and completely and utterly convinced, because I had long hippie hair
uh-huh.
that was past my shoulders. I had a beard. I looked like Gandalf the Brown. And I had this long beard, long hair, no visible tattoos, because uh-huh. that didn't start happening until recently.
Okay.
But he was just convinced, because he had TBI, traumatic brain injury. And
okay.
so this patient was watching me, and he saw me get off a motorcycle a few times outside.
So with all these
things in order,
okay.
he was convinced that he's out to get me. He's yeah. going to hurt me. Yeah. And then he stabbed me with a pen.
Fuck, dude.
And it was because I wasn't paying attention. I was doing a one-on-one with a different patient, so my eyes had to be locked on this other guy.
Jesus Christ.
And my head wasn't on a swivel. I thought my other guy at the apex of the hall was watching my back. He wasn't. He was on his phone.
Dick.
which led to my hardcore view on, you leave your phone in your pocket if you're doing a one-to-one in front of me, because I don't feel like getting hurt again.
Yeah.
But I got stabbed. I got sent to the ER to get patched up, which led to me getting a job in the ER.
Oh, that's so funny. Getting stabbed from your job. You're like, maybe I should get it on.
Maybe I need a new job.
A new job.
I really like what these guys do. Let me talk to one of them. And I talked to some of them. They're like, actually, yeah, we're looking at hiring some CNAs and MHTs and BHTs. Which I had the background in all of that at that point.
Nice.
So I got hired in the ER,
uh-huh.
which just, you know, I was on my A game. I was at my dream job. I was happy. I was working night shifts.
No stabbing?
No. Well, yes and no.
Oh, no. Again.
No stabbings, but I got beat on a lot in the ER.
Really?
Violence against nursing staff in ERs and ICUs
really?
Is extremely high.
Oh, no shit.
You got to remember, you've got mental health patients coming in that are coming off of a meth run. You've got violent criminals that have just now been brought in by the police that are only locked to the bed by one arm. You've got a lot of people that are on substances that do not realize what they're going on. And sometimes you have the sweet little grandma who has a UTI who now has the strength of a freaking trucker. and they are not happy with being there, and they're confused.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing you have to remember is these patients aren't trying to hurt you. They just don't know what's going on.
Yeah, of course.
So, when I started working in the ER, I was the guy that helped out with patients that were like that, that I would get called all the time because I was very good at de-escalation tactics.
Okay.
Having worked in Alzheimer's and dementia and having worked home health care with an Alzheimer's patient and working with forensic patients, I was really good at talking people off of that. Hey, come on, buddy. You don't need to hurt anybody. You can just talk to me.
Yeah.
I got a Snickers bar.
Yeah.
I can get some apple juice. We'll sit and talk. Yeah. Do you want a cigarette? We can go smoke a cigarette. You know, I was one of those guys.
Gotcha.
The voice of reason in a room of madness.
Mm-hmm.
And
you always have like this like mellow tone to you.
Mm-hmm. It's been a really good quality that I've had for a very long time. I'm very mellow outside of work.
Mm-hmm.
at work, I'm kind of a jerk because I'm in a leadership position. So one of my jobs is to make sure other people are doing their jobs while still doing my job.
Of course.
So it's a little different there. But outside of work, I try to be a very approachable person that anybody that sees me can just come up and talk to me about anything you want to. And I'm really not going to judge because I've known people of all walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
I got friends that own companies and I got friends that are still serving 10 to 20.
Yeah.
So like, I get it. Yeah. I fit somewhere in this gray area in the middle, like just pinpoint me here and I'm good to go.
Right.
But, while working in the ER, I saw people that had attempted to commit suicide that had blasted off the front of their face. Jeez. I had seen people have, you'd be amazed what people come in to the ER with as far as like funny things. I've seen people with things stuck in things that shouldn't be there. it's the polite way of putting that one.
Okay.
I've also seen homicides, stabbings, crush injuries due to car wrecks. Don't know if you know what degloving is, but I've seen a lot of that.
Degloving? No, I'm not familiar.
Degloving, when it comes to a person, is let's say that you get your hands stuck in like a fish cleaner for an industrial plant, and it just takes off the top layer of your skin.
Oh.
But in its entirety. That's what a degloving is.
Down to the bone?
No. Just the top layer so that all of your muscle and sinews and everything is visible. Oh. So it'd be like just if you flayed somebody.
Yeah.
If you've watched Game of Thrones, it's what Ramsay Bolton does.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
The flayed man.
Yes.
That's degloving.
Yes. Gotcha.
But I've seen a lot of those.
Jesus.
The one that, because while I was working in the ER, I went to rehab again for alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was good because I did a 5-month program and stayed for another 2 months and then lasted another 2 months sober. So I made it altogether 9 months sober that time around. And then I had one of the worst things I'd seen myself, because I worked in a cardiac and stroke was our main focuses at the ER I worked at. And our sister ER worked with pediatric and burn victims, but we were the ones that a lot of the trauma came to because they were union. We weren't. We got screwed.
Shit.
I didn't mind too much because it kept us busy. But we had a kid that got shot by his little brother by accident. They were playing with a firearm, and he got shot through the spleen into the heart, and it wedged itself in his sternum after losing momentum, which I'd never heard of happening before. So I saw the entrance wound. I'm in there. You know, I'm low level. I'm low level guy at this point. I'm an ER tech.
Yeah.
And I'm doing everything I can. I'm putting EKG leads on him. We're doing chest compressions because his heart keeps stopping. We're trying to figure out what's going on. The kid's like 16, 17. And we worked on him for an hour and a half. And we couldn't figure out why he kept coding. and they're doing an ultrasound, because you can use ultrasound besides just pregnancies.
Oh, yeah.
And they used an ultrasound, and they realized that, oh, he has a dime-sized hole in his heart.
The only thing
we're really doing is keeping his heart beating long enough for it to stop again. Mm-hmm. And they tell the family, and kid died. And I stepped out. We had extra scrubs and stuff in the back and a decontamination shower. So I dressed down. I go into the back. I get into another pair of scrubs after scrubbing off everything. Mm-hmm. And I get back to the nurse's station, and I'm told, hey, the kid, the little brother, he's being seen as a patient now. 'Cause the way those holds work is one of us sits with you while psychiatric services come and talk to you. Mm-hmm. And I know the kid saw me.
Yeah.
Go into the room with his brother, then come out in blood, and then come back out in different scrubs.
Yeah.
And now that same man, me, is sitting in front of your door while you're bawling your eyes out, and none of your family's around you because you're all dealing with the loss of the other brother that mm-hmm. this little brother just caused.
Yeah.
And I sat with that kid for 4 hours.
Oh, shit.
And talked to him and held him while he cried and did everything I could to keep it together myself. And the moment that I got relief, I stood up, walked outside, walked past the family and all the friends that are still crying, mm-hmm. made it to my truck and started bawling, like just crying, because I'd seen a lot of trauma and it didn't really affect me. That one did. Mm. That was a kid. Kids always hit home. It always sucks.
Yeah.
And I sat in my truck. I called my counselor, because at that point I was out of my former rehab. Mm-hmm. I called him. He didn't answer. Mm-hmm. He was in Kentucky. I was in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. He didn't answer. So I was like, all right, that's a sign. Fuck it. I'm going to go drink.
And shit.
I made it to my liquor store.
Yeah.
And they were like, where you been? You know, it was like a longtime friend.
Yeah, longtime friend.
Yeah. And I grabbed a half gallon of Beam's 8-Star, cheap shit.
Yeah.
And went to my favorite bar, where my favorite bartender was there. I will call her L. Mm-hmm. L saw me walk in. Uh-huh. She's like, where you been? Got sober. She's like, all right, where's your chip? I had my 9-month chip.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I put that on the counter.
That down. Here you go.
And she said, 9 free drinks.
Wow.
Because it was one of those kind of bars where if you you break your sobriety, and then they're going to fill you up with drinks.
Wow. I heard about that.
Yeah. They're all over the place. And it just so happened that my regular bar was one of those bars. I didn't know that up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I got white girl wasted because I hadn't drank in so long. I was like, this is fucking great. And I was back out in the madness for another 6-7 months before I finally was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. I'm ruining my life all over again. Mm-hmm. I'm breaking every promise that I made to myself and to people around me. And I woke up one day, vomited blood. I made a phone call to my dad this time. My mom's one that took me to rehab the first time in Kentucky. She drove me to Kentucky. She's like, I've been waiting on this phone call for months.
Ooh, all excited.
Like, yeah, she's all happy, and I'm like dying in the corner. Yeah. And this time I called my dad because my mom was out of town. And my dad was like, yeah, I'm on my way. I will be there in 20 minutes. I live 45 minutes away from where I worked, which is the same city that they lived in. I lived out in the sticks. Mm-hmm. And my dad got there in 15 minutes.
Whoa.
15 minutes. That's all it's
playing.
He said, I got here. I drove 110 miles per hour. And my dad is not one of those kind of people.
Wow.
He's just not. But he got there fast. Came inside the apartment, saw the red vomit and mm-hmm. the brown vomit on the floor.
Yeah.
Realized that, oh, that's blood. And my dad he's got a weak stomach. I love him to death. But if he sees it, he's going
to
puke.
Adds more vomit to it.
One of those moments. And, so he looks at that, sees how bad it is, and then goes, okay, do you need anything? I was like, I need clothes. And he's like, okay, we'll deal with that later. Get out in the car. And my dad, being the kind of person he is, just gets me in the car.
Yeah.
He couldn't help it. I didn't know what he was doing, but for another 20 minutes, he was just cleaning like the little bits of stuff that I had done mm-hmm. inside the house mm-hmm. up the best of visibility.
Sure.
and then going back out to the car to get me. Uh-huh. And then we drove back home. I made a phone call. I thought it was to the same people in Kentucky. Uh-huh. Nope. It was for a place out in Marietta, California.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yep. Way out.
Oh, yeah. The way in left field. I called them, and they said, yeah, this is one of the best. I cannot remember his name. But he sounded like this. He's like, yeah, we're going to get you right back out over here into Marietta. And they've got one of the best facilities in the entire nation. We're going to be just fine. You're going to do great. Mm. We'll take good care of you. You're going to be just good. I promise you. You'll make it through this. Just make it a couple days, and we'll get you on a plane, and we'll fly out here.
Yeah.
And they did. They paid for my plane ticket.
Fuck, seriously?
To come out to Marietta, California to go into detox. And I was in a house with five other people. And I was the youngest one in the house. Keep in mind, I'm 34. I'm not that old.
You're not that old at all.
But I was the youngest guy in the house. Everybody else was 60 to, like, I think the next youngest person was 42.
Okay.
But so I'm with a bunch of, like, old dads. And then,
that's so funny.
Like, and there's all these old dads and stuff, and then there's me. I'm like, hi. I'm hallucinating from withdrawal. Sorry, but when they drug tested me at the detox, I thought I had just alcohol and marijuana in my system.
Uh-huh.
Nope. I had alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, fentanyl, like just...
What?
Yeah, I still... Apparently, drunk Nathaniel loved drugs as much as...
Oh, great, yeah.
Druggy Nathaniel. Yeah. I was blacked out so often that I didn't realize that the shit that I was doing had all the rest of this stuff in it. Because I knew I did cocaine a couple of times. Yeah. I had no clue it was laced with anything. And from where I was, I weighed almost 300 pounds.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. I weigh like 234 now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing what happens when you quit drinking and eating like crap all the time.
Yeah. Fuck yeah, dude.
But
that's awesome.
When I went out to Marietta, they helped me out a lot, and they led me to Boardwalk Recovery. And
So this is all pretty recently then?
I'm coming up on a year on the 7th of March.
The 7th?
Yeah, the 7th. Oh. So we're almost there.
March 5th for me.
Very nice.
11. Yeah.
Don't worry. I will get there, sir. I will get there.
Yes, you will, dude.
But that led up to the last almost year of stuff that I've been doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've gotten to the point where I've got kind of two sponsors, one for sure, one kind of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's fine.
I've worked through all 12 steps. I'm pretty well known among the groups that I go to.
Like, yeah.
Most of the guys in HA know me,
mm-hmm.
At least in the groups that I go to.
Yeah.
And most of the PBAA community knows me pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. At least they know me as Nate from West Virginia. Like, if I hear that one more time, I'm going to go nuts. But I hear
it. We love our, what do you call it, our transplants.
Oh, yeah. And, but one of the things I get asked about all the time from my friends back home is, are you coming back? And,
oh, no shit.
Honestly, God, I love West Virginia. I love home.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that's really helped me was getting away from everything.
Yeah, the geographical.
Yeah, and they always say, you know, you take you wherever you go, and that is very true. You do take you wherever you go.
Absolutely.
But triggering memories can happen still. Oh, and some of those big ones is just driving by a house like, oh, yeah, I overdosed in there. Oh, yeah, I used to get fucked up with those guys.
Yeah.
I wonder what happened. Oh, yeah, they're all dead now. You know, just going through all those old memories. And the blessing and curse of ADHD is object permeance. And I have ADHD, hardcore. I don't know if you can tell by my storytelling technique.
I'm bouncing everywhere.
Hello. We're going to go here, now here, now here. But object permeance is a big thing with ADHD people. So if I don't see it, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't think about it, it doesn't exist. Mm. So it's a blessing and a curse. Because on the one hand, if I'm not actively thinking about all the shitty things I used to do, it does not bother me. The moment those floodgates open, though, I hit a wall. I hit a
tidal wave
just all the time. And so it's a good thing that I have a lot of people that I can call on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest things in my recovery is that's one of the reasons I don't want to leave is I've made good friends like yourself and a lot of the other guys that we mutually hang out with in the rooms. And a lot of the girls that we hang out with in the rooms. A couple of them have been on your show even.
Yeah, yeah.
But those are the kind of people that I reach out to, like on my really bad days when, you know, a patient dies at work or it's the anniversary of like Valentine's Day when I overdosed. Yeah, that I called so many people. Like, I'm so sad. It's like, it's because you're single? No, but thank you for reminding
me. Thank you for reminding me that, but there's more.
But, you know, I reach out to people, and that's a big part of my recovery process is not isolating myself anymore, reaching out to people.
Yeah.
And when I am in a point of isolation, because I work night shifts, so I'm isolated a lot on my days off just because of my sleep cycle. Like, I'll be awake until 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And that's just when I'm supposed to be awake anyways. So, and during those times, you are isolated. So I picked up hobbies like painting and making jewelry and writing poetry and writing short stories.
Nice.
And things that will, when I can't reach out or when it's not really cool to reach out because it's too late. And, you know, I'm not telling people don't reach out when you need to, but I've got this internal thing. It's like, oh, it is 2 o'clock in the morning. Don't you dare call somebody that you know works at 7 a.m. How would you feel? Like, it's one of those moments for me.
Okay,
now,
gotcha,
if you're having a real shitty day, fuck yeah, I'm still going to reach out to you. Like, if I am sitting in front of a liquor store and like, it's either I make this call or I go drink, I'm calling somebody.
Fuck yeah.
But, I do that a lot. I may have 11 months and some change, and I'm about to hit my year.
Fuck but, yeah, dude. Hold on 1 second. I just started learning to do this.
That's awesome. But I may only have this short period of time, but I've had, oh God, since I was, if we're counting my first overdose, since I was 10, and if we're counting when I started using regularly, since I was 12, and I'm 34 years old now. So I've had over 20 years. Of running and drugging and doing all the wrong things for all the wrong reasons. Even though a couple of my best character traits are, I like to help people.
Yeah.
Like, that is what keeps me going. If I wanted a better job that paid more, I would not work in healthcare.
Amen, brother. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, like, but I enjoy helping people. If I wanted to go back and make as much money as I wanted to, I'd fall back on my weapon specialty. And work on weapons because that pays so much better. But I do not like that old part of me.
Yeah.
I would rather spend my time working with patients that need help. Like, because that's a good feeling at the end of the day. Like, you get to see people get better and go home.
Yeah.
And mine may be physical rehabilitation. And I still work with a lot of addicts, a lot of alcoholics, and make sure that they get to the places they want to go and need to go in order to feel like themselves.
Fuck yeah.
And acts of service are a real big thing. Like, one of the things that I do, and it, you know, it just started off with just the fact that my nursing home needed clothes.
Oh, yes. But your announcements.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I donate clothes to my nursing home and to 5 other facilities. I also donate clothes to people down at the border that are affected by violence and seeking asylum. And I started doing that just because some of my patients were cold. Some of my patients needed clothes so they could do PT. And, you know, they come directly from the hospital and they have nothing.
Yeah.
So I started doing it for that reason. And now it's just become the, okay, I'm just the clothes guy. Like,
but that's fucking rad, dude. I love that you do that.
Yeah, it helps out a lot of people. And so I just, that's how I take up my time, is to make sure that when I have downtime, I can help other people. And my mom said it the best. You were built to help other people. That's why you are the way you are. And I come by it honest. That's how my mom and dad both are. My dad will go out of his way to help a student. My mom will go out of her way to make sure a patient feels welcome or that another coworker feels like they know all the information they need. And, all of the things that have happened in my life have led me up to a point where I have this awesome understanding of people because, you know, I've been a veteran. I've also been a shitbag criminal. I've been a shitbag in general. I've been a hardcore drug user. I've been an alcoholic. I've worked in healthcare. I've seen suicide both in a medical setting and in my personal life with friends, having walked into different things like that. And so it gives me a lot of sympathy and empathy for other human beings. Yeah. Doesn't matter how bad you think you are. Like, I promise you, I probably know something that's worse or on the same level. And
yeah,
I still love you either way.
Mm.
Like, I feel like if you can just show a little compassion, it goes a long, long way. And that's how I try to go with everybody in my life. I don't care about your past. Who are you now?
Mm.
And that applies pretty generally and liberally in my in my mind for most people. And I think it's a good way of living.
Hell yeah, dude.
Because if I can bring a smile to one person's face in a day,
yeah,
that's better than I was yesterday.
Yeah. Fuck yeah, dude.
Yeah.
And that's what they show. That's what they show us, you know, when we're in our road to recovery.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Yeah, dude.
Because if I didn't have some of the guys that led the way when you know, your brain's all mushy and you don't know what's left, right, front, center.
Yeah.
If I didn't have some of the guys like yourself and, you know, I don't want to name drop a bunch of
people, fine.
But you know, the guys I hang out with in the room. Yeah, if I didn't have those dudes, I had to have been lost in the sauce long ago. Like, just filled with resentment, filled with anger, and just went, oh, none of this works. You know, just walk away.
Yeah.
And then the probably end up on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I don't like being on t-shirts, so
we'll
keep this bearded mug off of there. And here with the Land of the Living, where I can do the most good.
Yeah, we love you here, man. Well, man, thank you so much for coming on my podcast, dude. And I just want to personally just thank you. And just like, I appreciate like your service, dude. I appreciate, you know, your service in the military, obviously, but your service that you do for everyone in the recovery community. And just, you know, and, you know, and all your ventures that you've done in your life, man. Like, you're totally like such a, like, almost like a hippie, like in a way. And, but you know, like it's so fucking cool, man, that, you know, you know what I mean? You lived that life and you made something out of it, man. And you know what I mean? Like I really fucking admire it, dude. You know what I mean? I really do. Brother. Like, man, it's fucking awesome, dude. And fuck yeah, dude. March 7th, dude.
Coming up soon. And best part is, my mom, my dad, and my brother will be coming into town.
Oh, fuck yeah, dude.
So I get to hang out with my little brother again and see all my family, except for my nieces and sister and sister-in-law. But, you know, they got the family thing going, so I get it.
Sure.
But, yeah, March 7th, and it's going to be a good week. I can feel it.
Hell yeah, brother. All right, man. Well, thank you so much again for coming on, brother.
Anytime, my friend.
Hell yeah, dude.
Whoop, whoop.
All right. Thank you, everybody.